by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host.
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George. How are you today?
Okay, fine. How are you doing up there in Missouri, okay?
I'm very much looking towards our interview with Dr. Donald Gibson here, yes.
Okay, well, yeah, we've got just a fine guest this evening. He's out of Pittsburgh, and he became a full professor in 1997 there at University of Pittsburgh at Greensburg. And he's also, he was active at the time with the American Democracy Project. He focused on higher education's role in preparing the next generation of informed citizens. He's a devoted teacher and scholar. He's written about, I think, 5 books, if I'm not mistaken. He can flesh this out on that when we get him on the air. He's a sociologist.
George?
Yeah, what's that?
I am so sorry. I thought I lost you.
Oh, okay. Anyway.
Please continue.
Yeah, his primary.
I thought so as well.
Yeah, his primary focus was sociology, and he's had a wide swath of teaching areas, including technology, social change, medical sociology, mass media. We'll bring him on. Welcome to our program, Dr. Donald Gibson.
Well, thank you for having me.
Is there any additional details here about your career and your teaching career that you'd like to add? I know we could talk probably for 15 or 20, 30 minutes just on your career.
No, what you did was fine. I spent about 10 years on Kennedy, 5 on the presidency, and 5 on the assassination. And I spent about 5 years on the environmental movement and a similar length of time on a mass media book, and then recently a book about globalism.
Right. Your one of your first books, was it not Battling Wall Street, the Kennedy Presidency? Did you start out with that originally?
Yeah, that was the first one, and I really had no idea of writing a book about that, except that I was interested in the development of multinational and transnational corporations and banks and what would later be called globalization. And my interest there drew me to looking at the post-World War II history of the American economy. And when I was done working on the 60s, 70s, or 70s and 80s, I felt I needed to know more about the preceding time, and that's when I started running into what Kennedy was trying to do. I had liked him personally, but I had not really pursued him as such until that point.
Do you think he was a progressive in trying to reform and save America in a way? What would be your perception there about that?
I think he had an absolute goal, and that was the general prosperity of the United States and of the world, which fueled his development of his Alliance for Progress. And so I think that was something that was pretty fixed in terms of his politics. But he was very flexible about how to get there.
Right.
So he was willing to rely on private interests when that worked, and he was willing to use government when that seemed necessary.
Right. He sat on a committee that investigated organized crime. I think Bobby was maybe the counsel to that committee. Did he begin to awaken at that point, or what are your thoughts there about that?
No, I think that he had his general perspective was there from the very, very beginning. And I think that showed up in his viewpoint of Vietnam in the early 50s, which was that we had to stay out of there unless we could get a government in South Vietnam that was willing to engage in reforms and to roll back the power of big landowners and to commit itself to the general prosperity of the country. That proved impossible, and Kennedy never really supported an American invasion of Vietnam. I think he got his general political orientation, though, partly from his father, partly from FDR, and partly from his own reading and thinking.
Right.
And he was a very independent thinker.
Right. He attended the, London School of Economics and Political Science in London? Is that right?
I don't think so.
I thought he did it one
time.
Oh,
yeah, you're right, briefly.
So I don't know if that was much of an influence overall. The whole name of that school is London School of Economics and Political Science. I don't leave that out because it's a schooling for one world government to many of the elites, it seems to be.
Well, yeah, and his father actually promoted that. He wanted him to be exposed to it, but I think only that he just wanted him to understand it and be familiar with it.
Right. He had an older brother that they lost during World War II, and was the firstborn Joseph Kennedy's first choice to do something on a national or international scale, and then John was, I guess, defaulted to John or what? Did you have any ideas there?
No, not really beyond the standard understanding of that, and that was that his son Joe Jr. Was ready to come home from England. He had served his duty and had done the required number of combat flights. And then this idea came up of loading airplanes with explosives and using that to attack certain strong positions that the Nazis occupied. And he volunteered to do that. He wasn't told to do it. He volunteered to do it, and somehow the plane blew up in the air.
Right. Your first book, Battling Wall Street and the Kennedy Presidency, how was Kennedy and Wall Street at crossways? What was some of the major problems that they had with one another?
Well, Wall Street believes that the private interests of major banks and globally oriented corporations are supposed to determine everything. And Kennedy was offering an idea of government which might, do what the Constitution requires of the Congress, and that is to promote the general welfare. And for Kennedy, that was first and foremost economic progress, and so that was the basis for that.
What were his views on the Federal Reserve System? I know at one time, did he not issue some silver certificates and so forth?
Apparently billions of dollars in government treasury notes of some kind were issued. I've never been able to determine exactly how those got into the economy. I suspect it was through state spending. Also, I don't think there's any conclusive evidence on exactly how much of that he did, but that it was at least probably $5 billion or more.
Okay. Now,
which in those days, a billion used to be worth something. So.
Well, who was that out of, who was that old senator? He says, well, it's not real money. We're talking about millions of dollars. He said, it's not real money until you get into the billions, right?
Yeah. That's at that level, it's true.
Yeah, so when you get into the billions, boy, that's some money. I guess the way Congress is. And the spending of Congress today, are they just out of control in their spending patterns?
Yeah, in important ways it is. I'm not one of those people who believes that reducing government spending or reining in government is always the thing to do. That depends on circumstances. But we are building up huge amounts of debt and also an international trade deficit, which keeps accumulating every year. And if you're going to have that, you really should make sure the money goes into the expansion of production and wealth, and that's not happening either. Debt's okay if you do what a small business person or an individual does, and that is you take on the debt for some useful or productive purpose, and in that way it serves a positive role.
Well, if you build something out there, you're serving the public's interest, something that's usable, bridges, or something, you know, the highway system or something that people can use. Then, but expending it on like weapon systems, that's just a waste, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Doesn't increase the ability to pay off those debts, and it doesn't increase the wealth of the country. The debt rolled up during World War II was huge. But almost all of it wound up being committed in one way or another to expanding the industrial base of this country. And so the prosperity that was based on that after World War II made it pretty easy to pay down those debts.
Right. So the 50s were in pretty good economic terms. It was an expansionary economy, it seemed like. I was growing up as a young boy there, here in Austin, Texas, during the 50s, and it seemed to, there were jobs out there, and people could actually have one salary and raise a family, support a whole family with one job, you know?
I think in Kennedy's view, the 40 to 55 period was very solid, but he thought that the economy was stagnating at the end of the 50s, and that's one of the reasons that he campaigned the way he did about getting America moving again.
Right.
And one of the first things he did as president was to send a proposal to Congress to try and increase the growth of the economy.
Right. The another book later you wrote was about, of course, we had Kennedy, and he was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963. Were you in the Air Force during that period, Dr. Gibson, or what?
I was a freshman in college.
Okay.
Yeah, and I had just enlisted in the military because of things Kennedy had said.
Okay.
So I had even though I didn't understand a great deal of it at age 18, I had felt a strong personal connection to him, and I was pre-registering for my second semester when I heard somebody say the president is dying or is dead. I thought they meant the college president.
Right.
So I got in my car to go home on a Friday afternoon, and that's when, I think it was Friday, and that's when I heard on the radio that it was the President of the United States.
Oh, my gosh. I was at Fort Devens, Massachusetts, and I was in the Army Security Agency. And we were a Texan in Massachusetts. It didn't go down well that day for Texans in Massachusetts.
Well,
and
Texans had very little to do with the assassination, as far as I can see.
Right, exactly. Anyway, this book entitled The Kennedy Assassination and Cover-Up, it seems like the assassination came from some of the highest levels, and then they proceeded to orchestrate a cover-up. What would your ideas be there in your comments?
Kennedy was in their way in a variety of ways. One of the most important I've come to believe, and I did see this when I wrote the book, but perhaps not as much as I do now, and that is the whole economic agenda in terms of global policy and foreign economic policy was being organized to serve the interests of global investors and banks. And Kennedy, as I mentioned before, had an entirely different orientation. He thought the government was to be used to spur on the growth of the national economy. And so he was going almost 180 degrees away from where they were heading, which was a world economy controlled through mostly finance and banking and investors.
Right. I was recently up there, and I did all the video for the JFK conference this last month. And I got up there, not for the first time, but where the railroad tracks were and then behind the picket fence. And in some places along that picket fence, it's only like 65 feet from where the X is in the street of Elm Street there. So they were close to him if there was a crossfire like Jim Mars would postulate and has written about.
Who was close to him?
Jim, what I'm saying is that I stood behind the picket fence in last month up there when I was doing the video work for the conference that we had. I did about 25, 30 hours worth of video. And standing behind the picket fence where it is today, they rebuilt it in there somewhat. It's only about 65 feet from the street where the first or one of the deadly shots hit Kennedy. So it was a close-up. If they had a shooting gallery, as some would maintain, it was pretty close triangulation. The shots were not very far from either the railroad track or the Dalcom building or from even the Texas School Book Depository or even behind the picket fence. So the Dow Tech building, I should say, was directly behind at an angle from Elm Street. But you maintain in this book entitled The Kennedy Assassination Cover-Up that some of the most important people, I guess LBJ became president automatically upon the death of John Kennedy. And one person at our conference maintained that they didn't even have to have a swearing-in ceremony because the vice president automatically is the president upon the death of the president. There's no swearing-in necessary. But that's what LBJ did anyway. So you're saying that there was a network, of people actually you're saying that Lee Harvey Oswald was more of a patsy than anything, and that's what the conclusion that we reached up there at that conference. But then there were high-level people that were involved in large organizations that continued to structure the Warren Report and the Warren Commission. How did that go?
Well, that was the whole investigation was premised on the idea that Oswald probably did it. And so they really didn't investigate other possibilities. And it's in the way they behaved around the investigation that I thought I found pretty clear evidence for conspiracy and pretty clear evidence indicating what circle of people was involved in having him killed. And as you just mentioned, that would be the very highest levels of American power and finance. And so we're looking essentially or generally at Wall Street and parts of the upper class. And that shows up in who controlled the investigation, Alan Dulles and John J. McCloy. And it also shows up in terms of how the Warren Commission was created with the involvement of people like Ross Dow and Joe Alsop and others.
Right. The Warren Commission was structured in such a way, like you're saying, to get – first they established this premise at the beginning that Lee Harvey Oswald did it, or was one of the main ones. Later on, they invented the magic bullet theory. But John J. McCloy was a very powerful member of the Warren Commission, was he not?
Oh, he sure was. No senator or congressman would be they would all recognize what they were dealing with there, because he was Mr. Fix-It for the upper class.
Yeah. I think he had connections to the Seven Sisters, of course, the Rockefellers, so forth.
Was he
High Commissioner of Germany after World War II? He had a high position, I know.
Yes, he was.
And then Alan Dulles was over there during the war in Switzerland with the OSS. And then Kennedy was, at odds with Alan Dulles because of the Bay of Pigs. And then John Foster Dulles. But you also made a very important point. I've talked to you before on this. But you said something about that John Kennedy wanted to establish a peaceful detente with the Soviet Union. What's that all about?
Kennedy was very anti-communist, nevertheless felt that there was no productive way to pursue things based on the idea of inevitable conflict, because we couldn't really have a nuclear war without destroying a good bit of the world. And so if you're not going to actually consider doing that, what are the alternatives? And one is to at least try and work out some sort of practical relationship where you can coexist. Part of that was Kennedy's offer to the communists to do the space exploration jointly. And he made two private offers of that, and I think two public offers. And the Russians never took him up on that. And so at that point, he decided that we would then do it alone, and we would also beat them.
Right. I've done a little research about Sukarno, president of Indonesia. And mm-hmm. I believe this insider group, the CIA and so forth, were running an operation to bring him down to a military coup. And I believe that from my readings that Kennedy was friends with Sukarno, and eventually this military coup group took over Suharto, is who they were backing, and he was, of course, pro-oil and all that. And did that figure into some of the problems that Kennedy had with Kennedy? He was too close to Sukarno?
Well, you know, in general, it's one of the important examples of the way in which the East Coast establishment or Wall Street or, you know, there's a whole bunch of names that have been used to describe them, the establishment, the Anglo-American establishment, whatever term we're using, that group of people intended to control foreign policy. And they were against both communist and they were against anybody who was an energetic nationalist leader because that meant that they were going to be, you know, have more trouble getting into those economies and especially getting control of assets or wealth inside those countries. The IMF was designed in the early 50s. The original IMF was one thing. It changed, though, around 53, 54. And what came after 53, 54 was an international agency that pretty much demanded that every country in the world open up its economy to foreign investors and foreign takeover. And that's what the upper class wanted, and Kennedy had no interest in that at all.
And I believe, well, then did John Kennedy and Joseph Kennedy, his dad, did they had different ideas. Is that true?
Apparently. I don't know what all of those were, and I guess a lot of them were just aired within the household.
Sure.
But
sure.
If you read Joe Kennedy Sr.'s book, I'm for Roosevelt, right away you see the continuity. And there was continuity. Hardly anybody mentions that book, but that was Joe Kennedy's book. I don't know how much of it he actually, you know, wrote himself.
Sure.
But it came out under his name, and it's a full-scale defense of FDR. So whatever people make of certain actions Joe Kennedy took, either before the Great Depression or after, his real track record is being a pretty progressive person.
Right. But he also had some ties with Lucky Luciano. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess.
So, I mean, that's some of the other flip side of Joseph Kennedy, I guess.
Well, I think there was some of that went on just because
Prohibition?
They shared a...
Prohibition? Or during Prohibition?
Well... Yeah, there was that connection, I guess. Kennedy made some money off of importing alcohol.
Yeah.
But I think there was also some shared sense of being an ethnic minority in America, you know, and that Italians and Irish, up until World War II, were pretty much kept out of the establishment.
Right. And John F. Kennedy, being Catholic and Irish, boy, him taking the presidency was a big surprise to the insider power group, wasn't it?
I think it was.
Boy, then they started waking up. You know, we don't have a friend here then, do we? Huh? This guy's on his own. He thinks he's a pretty brilliant president. I mean, he had a fine mind, did he not, John Kennedy?
Oh, yeah. I think so.
And
very much so.
So they began to have a problem with him from the original, you know, being around Austin here, we knew it, LBJ from the beginning. In fact, I flew back on one of LBJ's planes after the assassination and after that Christmas, you know, that LBJ was here in Austin. He was the president then. I got a hop back to Andrews Air Force Base. Well, when I was on that plane, I wasn't on the 707 Air Force One. I was on the Cooks and Bottle Washers Convair 2 engine plane. You know what I mean? But but I got into conversation.
Was that a C-130 or something?
No, it was just a Convair, I think they call it. It was two-engine, propeller-driven, and it went real slow, maybe 300 miles an hour, you know what I mean? And so
yeah.
So we plotted back in the air behind LBJ's plane. I mean, they was already there when we were still in the air. But I did get a free hop back because I was in the Army. You know, I was in the Army Security Agency at that point. And so, but we didn't know about LBJ and any involvement there. And now it's come out that there were many important people that were involved in the JFK assassination.
Yeah, so, one of which was not LBJ.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't. That stuff is crazy.
Well, goofy. Yeah. Well, we grew up here around him, and I would, you know, I would have the contrarian opinion there. But anyway, you wrote another book later on, and it's really relevant about what's going on in Paris. It is entitled Ecology, Ideology, and Power, okay? And what are some of your thoughts that you laid out in there? And then you got into Malthus and power and ideology. And just lay it out for us, Dr. Gibson.
Well, one thing that I was trying to trace out was the history of modern ecology or modern environmentalism,
yeah,
which used to, for decades, was generally called conservationism. And when I started getting into that, I quickly found that the primary two historical sources were Germany and England, and in different ways, but with similar ultimate characteristics. Both of those upper classes, German and British, were the real force behind the development of what came to be called conservationism.
Right.
And if you start looking at the words and statements and things that were said by early environmentalist leaders, they're openly reactionary, elitist, misanthropic in the sense that there's a general dislike of most human beings. And so what I then did was to see whether or not such ideas and values showed up in American conservationism, and it was quickly obvious to me that they did.
Right. The Club of Rome was formed, established in 68. And I think in the early 70s, there was limits to growth. Are these some of the examples of an insider group, very powerful, very rich, billionaire types, that would found a sustainability, I think it's called?
Yes. And the World Wildlife Fund is another important, very important early example. Because one of the people who's been in the news in the last week in relationship to the Paris meetings is James Hansen, and Hansen received about 10 years ago, he received an award from the World Wildlife Fund. Well, that was created in the early 60s by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands,
right?
And also the Queen's husband was involved, Prince Philip. And the World Wildlife Fund, in spite of its panda bear symbol, is actually a very elitist, very anti-progress organization, and is playing a pretty direct role through the person of James Hansen in this global discussion last week.
Right. I'm trying to think of a Canadian that just passed away out of Canada.
Maurice Strong?
Yes, Maurice Strong. How did he figure in this early on pretty well in the 70s?
Yeah, major figure.
Okay.
And he makes conspiratorial statements about environmentalism. I have one of them quoted in my book. I haven't looked at it in quite some time. But he pretty much clearly says that he thinks it's a good idea for the elites in the world to tell everyone else that there are limits to how good things can be and how much progress there can be.
Would you say that sort of reflects a Plato's view of, when he wrote in The Republic about an elitist, a philosopher elitist group that was over everything, or what? Is that what these elitists are about?
I guess some of them might try to use Plato for that purpose.
Right.
I don't think he in his overall work was that bad, but he might be usable in a very specific or slanted way.
Right. Are you familiar with the food for oil? I think that's what Maurice Strong got caught up in a scandal, I think.
I don't know too much about that scandal. My familiarity with him is primarily in terms of his environmental beliefs.
Well, he stepped down because of some revelation about a $900,000 check that he was made out to him. Then I think he moved over to China. See what I mean? And it seems like all these elitists are just collecting together, and some of them believe that the Chinese capitalism system is better than what we have, is what Rubenstein was saying at the World Economic Forum a couple of years ago.
Well, China's doing to some extent what Japan did in the 50s and 60s, right, using various state measures to back rapid investment in industry. And we did some of that at times during the Great Depression and during World War II and other times. So they're not really doing anything that's that different from what's been done in the past. What makes China different, I guess, is the size of the population and the fact that hundreds and hundreds of millions of people are currently being left behind in this rapid industrialization. But it's a direct challenge to the British and American upper classes, and so far they seem to be responding to the challenge by trying to take over China, and that's not going to happen.
Right. Charlotte, you have a question or anything? Charlotte, are you there?
I am, gentlemen. Sorry about that. Yes, I had the mute on. I didn't want to interrupt. I was learning so much.
Oh, okay.
I do have a question.
Okay.
I do have a question. So basically what I'm to understand is that the early founders of the environmental movement, see, I was in second grade, and my teacher asked who wants to be the president of the environmental endangered species club it was. And I remember that day I went home to my father and I said, yeah, Daddy, I won the vote. I'm the president of the Endangered Species Club. And he was quite taken aback, and he looked at me and he whispered in my ear and he said, kid, you're the endangered species. That was the best he could do under the circumstances of, you know, the education and stuff like that. But so you gentlemen are saying that the people that started the environmental movement would embrace capitalism communist style, or they would embrace it in some other way? I thought they were sort of anti-capitalist or anti-technology, anti-progress.
Well, they are anti-technology and anti-progress to some extent, although I think we could come back to their motives in a minute. What they're looking for, though, I believe, is one of probably several things they're trying to get out of the movement. One is to generate a belief system which tells people that progress is not, if not possible, at least it's not as possible as it used to be, and we're not going to have a great deal of it. That target of that seems to be primarily the American people, because I don't think it worked well, and I don't think it could have worked well in much of the world, and I don't think they ever expected it to. The other thing I think that they're trying to do with it is split off the educated class from the rest of the people. And if you can convince college graduated or college educated people that growth and prosperity and progress are over, then their identification with the rest of the people is going to be minimal. And that coalition, generally speaking, of the intellectuals and the lower classes was critical in Roosevelt's political success. And what they've done is split the educated from the working people, generally speaking. So those are two broad things maybe that they hope to get from it. And over the years, I've just become convinced that they sort of practice one-stop shopping, and that is, you know, they tried to get everything out of environmentalism they could.
Right.
because it was a major major effort to create it and spread it.
Yeah,
we're not booking. Yeah,
sustainability is everywhere.
We've got,
I think the upper class always does that when they do things. Once they've got it all done and they're ready to go, then they step back and say, "What else can we do with this?"
What else can we do to them, right?
Yeah.
We got them in a box now. Whatever else, what can we do? You seem to think, and you just said that the redistribution of power and wealth was based upon an economic growth based on technology, and they're not really for that, then, are they? The real elite and insiders.
They're not for general prosperity, but I don't think it's just meanness here.
Yeah.
I believe now what they decided in the 50s and 60s was that they were going to make a major effort to spread their influence and power globally through investment. They weren't going to have colonies, and they didn't want to go to war over for everything.
Yeah.
So how do you do this? And the one way to do it is to buy up parts of other countries, and then by that way get influence. But what did they need to do that? They needed vast amounts of money, and they also needed a population that could be told they're not going to have this as much. The American people, I mean. Because globalists and financiers and bankers and investors, they don't view the United States as a primary area of investment, unless it's for schemes and gains. They view the world as their investment.
You know, that's a good point. At COP21 there in Paris, there's always statements made about America using a great amount of energy and resources compared to everyone else. So this is sort of the build down of America's use of resources and power and so forth. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's part of it. I mean, apparently, this thing with China has probably surprised them a little bit. And I don't think they know what to do about it.
Right.
The growth of the Chinese economy, because eventually what this is going to do is it's going to call into question the status and value of the American dollar.
Right. And when that changes, we've got problems, right?
Yeah. Last week is the first time that the Chinese currency gained this special status in the world. There's only five currencies that have it.
I think the IMF proved that, didn't they?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, they did.
This is a sign, right, of it's a type of recognition that China is now one of the top economic players. And what are we doing with our economy? Except, as you noted earlier, I mean, we're building up vast deficits and debt, but we're not really taking care of our ability to create wealth.
Right.
To raise what one of John Kennedy's favorite people said was critical to national policy, and that is the increase of labor power.
Okay.
And that was Alexander Hamilton.
Okay. And what did that mean exactly? Expand on that a little bit.
When Hamilton used that phrase, which is a very advanced idea for when he did it.
Right.
Because it's 1791. What he was talking about was manufacturing. Hamilton made the case that if you want a real country, you're going to have manufacturing.
Right. And much of our manufacturing is offshore now. They've taken it offshore.
Yeah, well, between 2000 and 2010, we lost over a third of our manufacturing jobs. And the national media pretty much ignored it. You had a couple of exceptions, one of whom now has been taken off the air, Ed Schultz.
Yeah.
You familiar with him?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, he was one of the very, very few people who would, on national TV, tried to inform people about the deindustrialization of our country, and now they took his show away.
Well, in addition, you've studied and watched and observed the consolidation of the media into fewer and fewer conglomerates. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, the media that reaches You know, 40% of the American people probably don't read or watch very much of any kind of news at all.
Right.
And then another 40 or 50% basically trust the mainline media, and that's really five or so big companies.
Right.
So, you know, Time Warner and Viacom and News Corporation and a couple of others.
Is the average American distracted by too many things called entertainment and computer games and sports and love novels or whatever?
Yeah.
Is that where the American public, and let me ask you this too, the average student coming into your classrooms before you retired, what were they really into, and did political correctness and this microaggressions and all that trigger statements, did that take over or what?
It's a problem in the classroom, and I'm still actually teaching one class a semester just to, you know, keep myself going.
Sure, sure.
I pretty much go right at it in terms of I attack multiculturalism.
Sure. Okay.
And,
well, they don't like that at all, you know?
It was students who keep an open mind, I think.
I'm saying the power elite, they don't like that. You know, they're pushing multiculturalism.
Oh, yeah, because there's no basis for the unity of the people.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Because it elevates differences and it ignores common purpose.
Well, it's an attack on the nation state. That's what I see.
Also.
And a takeover by the corporate transnationals.
Yeah, well, you're supposed to accept all that under the so-called auspices of free trade or free enterprise. But as some people have pointed out and documented, most trade anyway is not free.
Charlotte, well, you've seen the rise of these corporations, and they become monopolistic, don't they, Charlotte?
Oh, yeah, it's been an interesting 47 years to watch the progress of our country. Gentlemen, I'd like to take the conversation back to technology. One thing that bothers me about the way things are changing so fast is that we might lose our freedom of speech on the internet, our ability to communicate in this new way, which is not a telephone and it's not print. And George, do you recall the second internet that we researched a couple years back? It was called OWL.
Yes. Yes. Well, there's the semantic web is what they call some of that. Okay. That's part of.
Well, my question would be this.
Yeah.
Well, my question would be this. These communication companies, you know, are, you know, just how nefarious are they going to interfere with our daily lives? I mean, how much can we communicate freely with the technology as it's arisen? I mean, as an American, I'm afraid to speak my mind online, not because I might be wrong, but because I might trigger somebody to come, you know, check me out. And that's America's big concern right now.
Yeah, what do you think, Dr. Gibson?
You're on George's show. I wouldn't worry about the internet triggering anything.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Dr. Gibbs, that's a good point.
You can't do anything in public in this country without potential of your being noticed.
Yeah, we're noticed. We're just not the big, you know, CBS or anything. We're way, way down the line, but we do have an influence of some kind. But, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah, so if you want, and I mean, generally it's true, right? If you want to do anything in public or politically, people will take note of you. I think, but I do also agree that we don't want a country in which somebody's surveilling everything we're doing.
No. And it's gotten worse in that area.
Well, I think, I've been convinced that we are, you know, being surveilled, and it's just getting more complicated as we go forward, gentlemen, because Cold War, you know, the Cold War mythology that I grew up with has changed, you know. I mean, China supposedly hacked Office of Personnel Management. I mean, that's a really big, you know, breach beyond, it's a breach of all breaches. I just don't, you know, do we know who's got the data and where it went? I mean, it was on C-SPAN yesterday. But these are personal, private information of millions of Americans.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Then they're private companies, right, that gather information on people. Hundreds of millions, tens of millions of people. They put together files on what you buy, what you read, what you buy at the grocery store and the bookstore. And all that information is then packaged and repackaged, and it's sold to anybody who wants it, right? From both commercial interest to the NSA.
Right.
Which I, and the world I work I was... for. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I worked for NSA without knowing it. For
Were you the Air Force Security Agency? Is that right?
Yeah, I was, and we were at Langley tapping the CIA's telephone telephones.
Well,
and it occurred to me,
yeah, well.
who has the juice to get us up here and tap the CIA?
Right, exactly.
It turned out to be the NSA.
Well, we were over. Charlotte's got a little story to come up here in a second too. I was in West Berlin on the top of the Teufelsberg, and we were Army Security Agency, you know, intercepting everything in the whole Berlin, East German area that we could get to, you know. But we were in contact with people in UK and Wall Street and everything else, you know. We were intercepting all that business traffic coming in and out of Wall Street. So. But Charlotte spent time in the Navy, and then she was a briefing officer, weren't you, Charlotte, there for a while?
What's that?
You were
the
in the Navy.
Part?
Yeah, you were in the Navy 5 years as an electrician's mate, I think, and then you became an officer in the Army, and you were a briefing officer, weren't you, on certain South Command?
Yeah, that's the best way to call me. That's the best way to think to call me. I was a briefing officer.
But also, did you support a team, one of those SEAL teams or what?
That was a totally different time. That was back in the 80s, and that was actually back in the early 90s.
Oh, okay.
Back in the early 90s.
Okay.
But you were still in the military?
Yeah, I was in the military back then. No, I was in the reserve. I was a sailor who had 5 years of active duty time, and I wanted to get some money for the weekend warrior program, to be honest, and I was putting myself to college. And I went back to the Navy, and I happened to be landlocked, and I landed up with some very interesting orders. and
So she's got some background.
I don't like
I've
to talk
some.
About it because I, well, here's why I don't like to talk about it. I'm one of the few females that's been trained as a combat infantry officer, and I just don't want the world knowing. I don't want to get on anybody's watch list or anything. I did not see combat. You know, it's just that I've been trained to the nines, and I worry about saying things because when, if anybody, you know, my words and my background to put the two together, I'm just your average American.
Right.
I mean, that's what I'm realizing, but I feel like a national security threat.
Right. Anyway, we have a collection here of experience, the three of us then, already, you know, and the NSA is just collecting too much information, the way I see it, you know.
Yeah, I don't know if... Yeah. What's his name? Snowden. I don't know if Snowden did what was right or not. I just don't know all the details well enough to make a judgment about it. But the concern he raised is valid. And the battle over what the intelligence services of all kinds are for has been going on probably for over 100 years.
Okay.
Right?
Yes.
And you know,
sure.
who's going to use the CIA? America as a nation acting in its own interest? We're the upper class, and that's been
right.
Right? Yeah.
Well,
the,
you know,
the same with
that's
with
it right
the
there. I mean, that's it in a nutshell.
Go ahead. Yeah.
The same with the military. I mean, that's what produced, you know, the first guy to really go public in a big way was Smedley Butler.
Yes, yes.
Right.
The war is a racket, right?
Yeah, who was deputy commandant of the Marine Corps, and he said, I'm tired of running Wall Street's errands.
Right. Well, he also exposed that conspiracy out of Chicago and New York to take over the government. I think under FDR, during FDR's first administration, I believe.
Oh yeah, no, that's right. Yeah. They went to him hoping they were going to use him
to be the commander.
They were so arrogant and stupid that they thought they could use Smedley Butler, and he of course just gathered information on them and turned it over to Congress.
Right.
Who did a half-assed job of investigating.
Well, yeah, so because they were protecting those same people, see? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it's been so corrupt for so many years. Are we gonna make it? Is America gonna make it, or is it the corruption that's just gonna destroy it, everything?
Well, Barack Obama came into office pretty much saying, well, I can't do anything about the economy, so let's go on to other issues.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in effect, that's what he did, because he allowed, you know, he just put together a team of people who were no different from the Clinton-Bush era.
Exactly, yeah.
And in fact, we're personally connected to the same people and the same institutions, right?
Exactly. Citicorp, CFR, Trilateral,
Citicorp,
all that, yeah.
Yeah, Goldman Sachs.
Goldman Sachs, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so
gentlemen, I think as important one, he didn't change his military advisors either, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, but there's a lot quit, Charlotte. A lot of some of the senior ones that differed with him have stepped down, retired early and stuff. Yeah.
Right. Well, we just have increased drone strikes. He's increased everything that happened under the previous administration.
Well, how can you give
all the numbers are up?
Yeah. How can you give someone like that the Nobel Peace Prize? You know what I mean? That told me that the Nobel. Oh, you know one thing that was added to that, Dr. Gibson? In the 60s, they created another prize, okay? Actually, the Peace Prize is awarded in Oslo, Norway, because Sweden and Norway were at peace at the time, and Sweden decided to go ahead and let that be awarded in Oslo as a goodwill gesture in, you know, Oslo, Norway. The other prize that was created since the original creation of the Nobel Prizes was the prize in economics, and the Central Bank of Sweden was behind that.
Huh. I didn't know that.
It figures, doesn't it? Because I see what they've done is they tried to establish the credibility and a foundation that they could build their modern money and financial operations on top of. And that just added to the credibility of the study of economics and giving and then finance and banking and all that.
Apparently from, you know, 1933 to about 1980, economics education in America was pretty flexible and broad and inclusive, except for socialism or communism.
Right.
But since the early 80s, this doctrine of absolute laissez-faire took over. And, of course, what that really just translates into in practice is allowing private wealth to do anything it wants.
Right. Well,
and of course we pay the bill for them if things go south, as we did in this financial disaster.
Exactly. And now in January, towards the end, will be the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, and that's where over 2,500 corporations meet yearly. And one little side note here, Prince Bernhard was actually founder of the Bilderberg Group also.
Yes.
In 1954.
Yeah.
And so that's an important, milestone or whatever.
Yeah. Well, all of this is so alien or foreign to what America felt like 35 years ago. And we were under such a, you know, practical, progressive oversight from Roosevelt through Kennedy, and with some exceptions in there, of course, but at least the country had a deep-seated rationality to it. You know, we did at least behave rationally in the sense of doing things to elevate the standard of living and create the ability to solve problems and do things. And in the last 30 years, we just watch while various interests wreck a country.
Right. Well, we had American exceptionalism at the time in the 50s, from what I experienced. And then, now with all the multiculturalism and all that, they've just segmented everything, you know, up with these cultures.
Yeah, well, I don't think too many people have received much information on what the revolution was really all about.
Right, right. Charlotte and I, saw, we're watching, during Thanksgiving, I went up to Missouri and spent a little time up there. We're watching a documentary on the history of human rights, okay? And, mm-hmm. and, they actually, took and defined, the natural law or natural rights into human rights. And then through this documentary of 9 minutes long, they showed that, that where natural law and natural rights evolved into human rights. So, and then they said the UN was the big dog to give you the human rights. See?
To what, why would they want to change the use of the word?
Because they're coming from constructions of men versus natural law and natural rights. They're transforming the Constitution and Declaration, and they're overriding mm-hmm. it with the human rights thing issued to you by the UN through the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Thing. Okay. Well,
in other words, it's man-based system, see? Charlotte, what? What'd you say, Charlotte?
I was going to say the idea that natural law suggests or has been interpreted or, you know, man has come to the conclusion through various wars and struggles, you know, that a natural right to defend yourself, a natural right to speak your mind, a natural right not to be insecure in your person, you know, not having people, you know, invading your home and stuff like this. Those are what Americans consider natural rights, not human rights. A human right is a right that can be given by human laws, and then they decide, well, if, you know, your freedom of speech, for example, the free speech zones on universities, or once you say you can only have free speech in that box, you're really walking down that road of, you know, because a free speech and Second Amendment, that's not a human right. Those are natural rights. And I think the reinterpretation of that word, natural rights, or, you know, the whole foundation of Western civilization is not going to shift that quick.
Right. Well, anyway, that's an interesting idea. I think they're just trying to destroy the natural law and natural rights and bring forth this human rights to be the to govern and to manipulate through myself. Well, Dr. Gibson, do you have any closing comments? We're about got about a minute. Go.
We have to find some way to shape our country's policies, tax policies, investment policies, everything that's of importance, shape it to do what Alexander Hamilton originally said, and that is give people a life through economic progress.
Right.
And I think we have, if that's not done, we're facing a lot of just ugliness.
Well, I came up with an idea called financial rights one time. And I think they've reformed some of this credit stuff over the years. But what I'm talking about is something that gives individual citizens financial rights so that they're treated equally, you know. But maybe we can think
Roosevelt
about that.
Offered. Yeah, Roosevelt offered something like that, his economic bill of rights.
I see. Well, we want to thank you this evening, Dr. Gibson, and your writing has been very insightful and informative and very productive and very positive for the country.
Thank you.
We want to thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed being here to talk to you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Okay. Good night.
Okay. Good night.
Okay. Okay, Charlotte. That's it. We're going to wrap it up, and we'll talk to you later, okay?
All right. Thanks, George.
Okay.
Good night.
Yeah. Good night, Charlotte. Bye-bye.